I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
When they shut down the internet, followed by the protests of the people, we issued a statement saying that the complete shutdown of the internet and telecommunications will end in a massacre. But we never imagined the massacre to be in such dimensions and for there to be a bloodbath.
As the reported death toll in Iran rises to 2,600, we'll speak to the world-renowned Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi about the unprecedented protests, Iran's brutal crackdown, and his new film, It Was Just an Accident. The film was secretly shot inside Iran and has been shortlisted for an Oscar. But first, here in the United States, the FBI raids the home of a Washington Post reporter and seizes her phone and laptops. We'll speak to Jamil Jaffer of the Knight First Amendment Institute.
These kinds of raids of newsrooms, searches of reporters, are the hallmarks of illiberal regimes. They have been very rare in recent American history, and we want to keep them that way. It's hard not to see this as a kind of shot over the bow of the press and attempt to intimidate not just the press, but sources who would communicate with them.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. has withdrawn military personnel from bases in the Middle East as President Trump has repeatedly warned the U.S. will intervene on behalf of the protesters in Iran. By Thursday morning, Iran shut down its commercial airspace for a number of hours. A senior Iranian official said Iran had warned its neighbors in the region that it would hit American bases in the event of U.S. airstrikes. This comes as Iran postponed the execution of Erfan Soltani, the 26-year-old protester sentenced to death just days after his arrest. More than 2,500 people, including 147 security officials, have been killed since protests began December 28th. That's according to the U.S.-based human rights activist news agency. Iranian authorities have imposed an internet shutdown across Iran, but videos of the deadly crackdown on protesters have been trickling out of Iran via smuggled Starlink terminals. In one video, at least 100 bodies held in bags await identification at a morgue in Tehran. We'll hear from the world-renowned Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi later in the broadcast. The State Department said Wednesday it'll indefinitely halt processing visas for immigrants from 75 countries, after claiming without evidence people from those nations often receive public benefits after arriving in the U.S. Immigrants from over a third of the world's 193 countries will be affected by the sweeping restrictions, which are set to begin January 21st. Among the targets are Afghanistan, Brazil, Colombia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Iran, Iraq, Nigeria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. This comes on top of total or partial travel bans on visitors from 39 countries. In Minnesota, federal agents fired tear gas, pepper balls, and stun grenades at protesters who gathered late Wednesday near the scene where a federal agent shot and injured a man in North Minneapolis. Mayor Jacob Frey said after the shooting that details remain unclear, even as he once again condemned ICE's surge of agents into the Twin Cities. Witnesses told the Star Tribune a series of gunshots followed a car chase and foot chase involving federal agents who reportedly ordered residents to come out of their homes with their hands up. Several people, including children, then walked out into the freezing cold. According to the Trump administration, the gunshot victim was shot in the leg, the administration said, after he began to resist arrest and, quote, violently assault an officer. Minneapolis has recorded three shootings since New Year's Day. Two of them were by federal agents. In a video statement released shortly before the latest shooting, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz condemned what he called a, quote, campaign of organized brutality against the people of Minnesota by our own federal government.
Armed, masked, undertrained ICE agents are going door to door, ordering people to point out where their neighbors of color live. They're pulling over people indiscriminately, including U.S. citizens, and demanding to see their papers. And at grocery stores, at bus stops, even at our schools, they're breaking windows, dragging pregnant women down the street, just plain grabbing Minnesotans and shoving them into unmarked vans, kidnapping innocent people with no warning and no due process.
Among non-immigrants who've been swept up by ICE's campaign of racial profiling are four members of the Oglala Sioux tribe, three of whom remain jailed in an ICE facility at Fort Snelling, south of the Twin Cities. It's the same site where, in 1862, U.S. forces imprisoned about 1,700 indigenous men, women, children, and elders following the U.S.-Dakota War, where many died of torture, starvation, and disease. Survivors were exiled to reservations in what's now South Dakota. In California, 21-year-old Caden Rumler says he was left permanently blind in one eye and narrowly avoided death after a federal agent fired a crowd control weapon into his face during an anti-ICE protest in Santa Ana last week. Rumler had joined the protests against the killing of Renee Good by an ICE agent in Minneapolis when a federal agent fired a so-called less lethal round at close range that struck his left eye. He was then dragged by an agent across a plaza, his face covered in blood as he complained, "I can't breathe." He says he pleaded for agents to call an ambulance as they mocked him about his injured eye. He ultimately underwent 6 hours of surgery to remove plastic, glass, and metal from his face and skull, with one piece narrowly missing his carotid artery. Rumler says doctors told him it was a miracle he survived. An investigation by ProPublica has documented over 40 cases in which federal immigration agents use potentially fatal chokeholds and other moves that can cut off breathing against immigrant citizens and protesters. Former police and immigration officials who review the footage call the agents out of control, with one calling it, quote, the kind of action which should get you fired, unquote. Meanwhile, top officials in Maine are warning ICE agents are preparing to surge federal agents into the cities of Lewiston and Portland, where, according to MS Now, they're set to target Somali refugees in the coming weeks. On Tuesday, the Trump administration ended temporary protected status for Somali immigrants, ordering them to leave the U.S. by March 17th. Danish Foreign Minister Lars Rasmussen said there is a, quote, fundamental disagreement, unquote, with President Trump over Greenland, the semi-autonomous territory controlled by Denmark. The comments came after the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland met with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio Wednesday at the White House, as President Trump has repeatedly called for the U.S. to militarily take over Greenland. Here's Denmark's Foreign Minister Lars Rasmussen.
For us, ideas that would not respect territorial integrity of the Kingdom of Denmark and the right of self-determination of the Greenlandic people are, of course, totally unacceptable. And we therefore still have a fundamental disagreement, but we also agree to disagree. And therefore we will, however, continue to talk.
President Trump's Middle East envoy says a U.S. brokered plan to end Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip has entered its second phase. Steve Witkoff made the announcement in a social media post, writing Gaza is, quote, moving from ceasefire to demilitarization, technocratic governance, and reconstruction, unquote. Witkoff added, quote, the U.S. expects Hamas to comply fully with its obligations, including the immediate return of the final deceased hostage. Failure to do so will bring serious consequences, unquote. Witkoff made no mention of Israel's frequent ceasefire violations. Gaza officials say Israel's broken the truce about 1,200 times since it took effect October 10th, killing over 440 Palestinians. On Tuesday, yet another winter storm swept over Gaza, flooding hundreds of tents and collapsing homes, sheltering families displaced by more than 2 years of Israel's assault. At least six people have died from the latest storm, including two women and a girl, killed when homes collapsed near Gaza City's beach, and a one-year-old boy who died of hypothermia in a tent in Deir al-Balah. This is Nagma Afiuma, a 12-year-old Palestinian displaced with nine family members in Gaza City.
Last night, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen anything like this on ordinary days. I've never seen anything like it. We were drowning. Our clothes that we had became wet. We have nothing to wear. We are children. We want. Our two mattresses were soaked. Our covers were soaked. Our pillows that we sleep on were soaked. Our tent is filled with water.
A Senate War Powers resolution aimed at limiting President Trump's authority to take further military action against Venezuela failed Wednesday after two Republican senators, Josh Hawley and Todd Young, withdrew their support. Vice President J.D. Vance cast the tie-breaking vote to dismiss the measure. Meanwhile, the U.S. completed its first sale of Venezuelan oil, valued at about $500 million. Semaphore reports the revenue from the oil sales is currently being held in bank accounts controlled by the U.S. government, and that the main account is being held in Qatar. On Wednesday, President Trump told reporters he held a very good call with Venezuela's interim leader, Delcy Rodriguez, calling her terrific. He's also expected to meet with the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, today at the White House. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, pro-government protesters have been gathering daily, calling for the release of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, from U.S. custody.
The empire can do whatever it wants, but we are here to tell them that we are free, sovereign, and independent. They can meet with whoever they want, but they have to meet with those who represent the government today. They have to free Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, our president.
FBI agents raided the home of Washington Post reporter Hannah Nattinson on Wednesday. Authorities seized her phone, two laptops, and a Garmin watch. She spent the past year covering the Trump administration's efforts to fire the federal workforce. Matt Murray, the executive editor of the Washington Post, said in a staff message, quote, this extraordinary aggressive action is deeply concerning and raises profound questions and concern around the Constitution protections for our work, unquote. According to the Washington Post, investigators reportedly told Nattinson she wasn't the target of the probe. A warrant obtained by the paper cited an investigation into a government contractor with a top secret security clearance who's been accused of taking home classified intelligence reports. In a statement, Attorney General Pam Bondi said the warrant was executed at the request of the Pentagon and that Perez Lugones had been arrested. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Several Democratic lawmakers said Wednesday they're under investigation by the Justice Department over a social media post in which they reminded U.S. service members they have a duty to disobey illegal orders. Congress members Jason Crow, Maggie Goodlander, Chrissy Houlihan, and Alyssa Slotkin received inquiries from U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro requesting interviews about their participation in this video posted last November.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders.
No one has to carry out orders that violate the law or our Constitution.
Congressmember Slotkin said Wednesday she also received an inquiry from the FBI's counterterrorism division late last year. That followed President Trump's call for the lawmakers to be tried for treason and put to death.
To be clear, this is the president's playbook. Truth doesn't matter, facts don't matter, and anyone who disagrees with him becomes an enemy, and he then weaponizes the federal government against them. It's legal intimidation and physical intimidation meant to get you to shut up.
And President Trump toured a Ford auto plant in Dearborn, Michigan, Tuesday, where an auto worker was caught on camera calling the president a pedophile protector. President Trump then gave the auto worker the middle finger and mouthed F you twice. Ford suspended the auto worker, TJ Sabula, without pay after his exchange with President Trump. Since then, GoFundMe campaigns have raised over $700,000 for Sabula. On Wednesday, Laura Dickerson, the United Auto Workers vice president and director of the Ford department, said in a statement, quote, the auto worker at the Dearborn truck plant is a proud member of a strong and fighting union, the UAW. He believes in freedom of speech, a principle we wholeheartedly embrace, and we stand with our membership in protecting their voice on the job, unquote. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has released less than 1% of the Epstein files. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at press freedom under attack in the United States as the FBI raids the home of a Washington Post reporter, seizing her phone and laptops. Stay with us. By Downhill Strugglers performing at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. On Wednesday, the FBI raided the Alexandria, Virginia home of a 29-year-old Washington Post reporter, Hannah Nattinson, who covers the Trump administration's reshaping of the government and its effects. The president of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press called the raid a, quote, tremendous escalation in the administration's intrusion into the independence of the press. FBI agents searched Nattinson's home and seized a phone, a Garmin watch, her personal computer, and one owned by the Post. Agents reportedly told Nattinson the raid was related to their investigation of a government contractor and Navy veteran named Aurelio Perez Lugones, who's accused of illegally retaining classified government materials. He was reportedly messaging the reporter at the time of his arrest last Thursday.
Just last month, Hannah Nattinson wrote a piece headlined, I am the Post's federal government whisperer. It's been brutal, unquote. She said her reporting had led to more than 1,000 new sources who were current or former federal workers, quote, who wanted to tell me how President Donald Trump was rewriting their workplace policies, firing their colleagues, or transforming their agency's missions, unquote. Nattinson was also part of a Washington Post team that won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for their coverage of the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Readers of the Washington Post coverage of Wednesday's raid on the reporter's home left thousands of comments noting the paper's owner, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, had so far not commented on the raid. For more, we're joined in our New York studio by Jamil Jaffer, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, previously deputy legal director at the ACLU. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jamil.
Thanks, Anna.
Why don't you explain to us what you understand happened on Wednesday morning when the FBI raided the home of a reporter?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, a reporter who's been covering the federal government, talking to government employees, publishing stories about her conversations with government employees. And her home was raided by the FBI. It's a very unusual thing, you know, extremely rare in this country that the FBI raids the home of a reporter or raids a newsroom. Thankfully, very rare in our recent history, at least. But that's what they did in this case, and they seized her electronic devices, including two laptops, one of which was issued by the Post, and a cell phone as well. And not at all obvious to me why this search was necessary at all. They had already searched the home of this contractor a week before and obtained, apparently, evidence that he was sharing classified information. So they, you know, already had that evidence against them. They filed a criminal complaint against them. And a week later, they execute this search of a journalist's home. And we don't yet have the affidavit in support of the search, so we don't know what they told the court to justify this search. But it's hard not to see it as an effort to intimidate not just journalists, but the sources that would communicate with them.
So, Jamil, could you explain what kind of legal authorization is typically required for this kind of search, in particular, yeah, of a journalist's home?
Yeah. So it's a very complicated legal landscape, mainly because the Supreme Court issued this decision in 1972, which is, to put it generously, very cryptic. Nobody understands what that decision really means. But, you know, essentially, the court said, we're not going to extend special constitutional protection to journalists with respect to their sources. You know, we're not going to let journalists refuse to testify, for example, before a grand jury when they're subpoenaed for their sources. But in the same decision, the court said, obviously, there are constitutional implications to some of these requests, and we're going to be very careful that the government doesn't cross constitutional lines. So it's a cryptic opinion. There's a concurrence by Justice Powell that people have, you know, taken to be the controlling opinion of the court. But the result is that there's this very messy judicial landscape. Congress has been asked over and over again, urged over and over again by press freedom organizations, including the Knight Institute, to pass legislation that would give reporters clearer protection against compelled process. So not just subpoenas, but also court orders and search warrants of the kind that was, you know, at issue in this particular search. But Congress has failed to do that. And in the meantime, the only protections that journalists have are the ones that the Justice Department wants to, or the main protections that journalists have are the ones that the Justice Department wants to provide. And the Biden administration had provided, had strengthened the rules protecting journalists in very important ways. The Attorney General, the current Attorney General, Pam Bondi, weakened those rules last year. Press freedom advocates knew that the weakening of those rules would result in a kind of stepping up of investigations of the press and their sources. And this search, I think, is a sign that we were right to worry.
It's really serious when you look at, she's not even the actual target. They're
right.
Saying they yeah. get the information. You can't help forget here that she is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She was part of the team that investigated what President Trump doesn't want to talk about, mm-hmm. which is the January 6th insurrection.
Yeah. Well, so I think that one of the really worrying things here is that presumably they justified this search to the judge by saying this relates to this contractor who was sharing classified information, was taking classified information home unlawfully and then sharing it. And that's how they justified the search to the judge. But this reporter has all kinds of information, all kinds of communications with sources that have nothing to do with classified information, right? All these communications with current government employees, for example, including conversations that are not national security protected. They don't touch on national security issues at all. And now the government has possession of all of those communications. And we don't know whether any protections have been put in place to segregate those communications, or whether the Justice Department is just sifting through them right now.
And what kind of recourse, if any, legal recourse, does the reporter Hannah Nathanson, or indeed the Washington Post, have in light of what's happened?
The owner, Jeff Bezos, quite close to President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite striking that, at least to my knowledge, I think you said this in the intro as well, that Jeff Bezos hasn't said anything about this search. I mean, this is a huge attack on not just press freedom, but his. His outlet, the Washington Post, and that he hasn't come to the defense of the newspaper or the journalist is pretty striking.
And what about the fact? What about the Post itself? It can't do anything.
I think that the Post can do something. I mean, there was a strong statement from the executive editor, and the Post could go to court and, at the very least, demand that the judge impose restrictions on what the government can review here, ensure that the only information the government has access to is information relating to the search of the contractor. At the very least, and maybe they could challenge the search in broader ways as well. I'm sure that they are thinking that through now. I hope that they will go to court.
And quite terrifying, the fact that she is known as the government whisperer, that thousands of workers have turned to her. They will know who those workers are.
Yeah, I think that's why it's hard not to see this as an effort to intimidate the press.
We want to ask you about another issue. The House Oversight Committee is facing growing criticism for voting to subpoena the prominent investigative reporter Seth Harp after he posted publicly available information about a Delta Force commander who reportedly played a role in the recent abduction of the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. Harp's the author of the book, The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. On Monday, 20 press freedom and First Amendment groups, including the ACLU and Reporters Without Borders, called on the House committee to rescind the subpoena, saying Harp's reporting is, quote, fully and squarely within the protections of the First Amendment. Your response, Jamil?
I mean, my organization didn't sign that letter, but I agree 100% with what the ACLU and other organizations wrote. I mean, this is plainly First Amendment protected activity. You can publish information that is already publicly available, and the fact that the government says that this information is classified doesn't actually change the calculus, because the First Amendment protects the right of news organizations and journalists to publish government secrets. So I think that this is yet another effort, this time by Congress, not the Justice Department, to intimidate the press, to deter the press from doing work that all of us need the press to do.
So you're racing out of here to catch a plane to go to Boston. You're dealing with the AAUP case that challenges the Trump administration's policy of detaining and deporting international students and professors who participate in pro-Palestine protests. Can you explain where this case stands now?
Yeah, so this is, as you say, a case in which we're challenging this policy of targeting student protesters. And we had a trial over the summer before Judge Young, William Young, in Boston, after which he issued a 168-page opinion, holding that the government's policy of targeting these foreign students on the basis of their pro-Palestinian activism was unconstitutional. So he's said that already, but he hasn't yet given us a remedy for the violations that he's identified. So today's hearing is about essentially what can the court do about the constitutional violations that he's already recognized. So it's a really important hearing. It's this afternoon in Boston.
And can you talk, next week marks the one-year anniversary of Trump having been in office, the attacks on the press that have happened in the last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible time for press freedom. And the important thing about that is that we need the press to inform the public about the government's actions and decisions, and to help us hold government officials to account. But the Trump administration is, engaged in a kind of all-out assault on press freedom. You see it in so many different ways. Like, at the ground level, just the kinds of abuses that you see ICE agents and other federal officials engaged in, other federal agents engaged in with, you know, against reporters, but all the way up to the consolidation of control over some of the nation's largest media organizations, including CBS, and possibly soon TikTok and CNN as well.
Speaking of CBS, this is the new CBS news anchor, Tony DiCupio, closing out Tuesday night's broadcast with a salute to Secretary of State Marco Rubio.